It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. 18 months ago, many of us knew little, if anything, about stand your ground laws. But then on February 26th, 2012, a Florida man named George Zimmerman shot and killed an unarmed 17-year-old named Trayvon Martin. Prosecutors say Zimmerman profiled the black teenager, assuming he was about to commit a crime, followed him, and killed him. Zimmerman says he acted in self-defense, and his lawyers will no doubt rely on Florida's expansive Stand Your Ground law as part of their case. I'm joined now in Studio A by Pitt Law Professor David Harris. He's a member of an American Bar Association National Task Force on Stand Your Ground laws, which is holding a regional hearing in Philadelphia this Thursday. David Harris, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Paul, it's good to be with you again.
And you can join our conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address, essspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at essspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. What questions do you have about Stand Your Ground laws? You may be wondering how they apply to those of us in Pennsylvania. 412-246-2002. 2002, the number to call. So, David Harris, what are Stand Your Ground laws?
Well, Paul, Stand Your Ground laws go to the very core of the laws on homicide and self-defense. Our homicide and self-defense laws go back to our heritage as English colonies in the United States. And it's always, of course, been illegal to commit murder. And there's always been a right to self-defense. If you are illegally attacked, even with deadly force, you are entitled to defend yourself with deadly force if necessary to meet that threat. Now, under the English law and the earlier American law, the emphasis was always on avoiding violence and bloodshed. So you could defend yourself with only a proportional amount of force, but if you were attacked with deadly force, you could use deadly force to defend yourself. If you could escape the deadly attack without risk to yourself, if you had an avenue of completely safe retreat, you were obligated to take that way out instead of just turning around and resorting to defensive violence. That's been the rule in England and the United States for hundreds of years, literally. Along comes the Stand Your Ground law. Now, there's always been an exception to that rule of retreat for your home. This is the so-called castle doctrine. You don't have to retreat inside your own home because that's your ultimate place of retreat. What the Stand Your Ground laws do is they take that idea that you don't have to retreat, that you don't have to walk away, even if you can do so safely, and they bring it out of the home and put it in the public square, in the public arena. So now, anywhere you have a place you have a right to be, the public street, a park, anywhere at all, your workplace, you don't have to retreat, even if you could do so safely. You could turn around and resort to deadly force to defend yourself. You could stand your ground. And you would be presumed to be correct in doing that. That's the essence of these modern laws, the first of which was Florida in 2005.
So Stand Your Ground extends the so-called castle doctrine in criminal law, that if based on this castle doctrine, if you were attacked while you were standing on your own property, you could defend yourself. It's protecting your and it's castle. It's named.
Yes, exactly.
It's you're protecting mm-hmm. your castle as opposed to the law being named for someone named Castle.
Mm-hmm.
And so explain again how they extend regular self-defense law. It extends then from the premises, these Stand Your Ground laws.
Yeah, that's right. This does go back to the idea that the person's house is their castle. Think of the old thatched huts in ye old England. And even the king could not come into your home. Needed a warrant, and you couldn't be attacked in your own home. Your own home is your ultimate place of retreat, so there was no duty to safely retreat within your own home. You're already where you need to be. So the idea of Stand Your Ground laws was to take that same idea that you don't have to retreat and take it outside the premises of your home. So in other words, I don't have to retreat from a deadly attack in my own home, but now under Stand Your Ground, I don't have to retreat in the street, I don't have to retreat in a park, I don't have to retreat in a store or in my place of work. Now I have that same right everywhere to resort to deadly defensive violence if that is my choice. I don't have to try to get away.
Okay, so what's the difference between that and the regular self-defense law?
Self-defense law is sort of underlies all of this.
Okay.
You're not obligated to just take a deadly attack on yourself. You can stand up for yourself. As long as you didn't provoke the attack, you can defend yourself with a proportional amount of force. If you're attacked with fists, you can defend yourself with fists. If you're attacked with a deadly weapon, you can use deadly force to defend yourself. What this does is it allows you to use deadly force without having to retreat. That was the big piece of old self-defense law that Stand Your Ground goes through. Instead of having to run away, if you could do so in complete safety, to avoid all bloodshed, you could turn right around, stand your ground, and resort to deadly defensive force without retreating. That's the big difference.
And we'll get into how Florida's law is even more expansive. But we have a caller from Squirrel Hill. Amy is on the line at 412-246-2002. Amy, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much. My question is, how much can someone antagonize? The example of the George Zimmerman case, it seems that he was following Trayvon. He was asked to step away and, in a sense, antagonized him to the point that Martin retaliated, and then he can turn around and say, well, he attacked me with deadly force, and now I'm standing my ground. So how much can you sort of incite somebody that then you can use Stand Your Ground as a defense?
Great question.
Yeah, Amy, the answer there is antagonizing somebody, following them, that isn't enough. What we have to have for any self-defense is you facing an attacker using illegal force against you. If the attacker uses less than deadly force, you can defend yourself with less than deadly force. Fists, you can use fists. But if they mount a deadly, lethal attack against you with, say, a weapon, a deadly weapon, you may defend yourself with that level of force. Stand Your Ground simply takes that idea and says you don't have to turn around and try to get away first. You don't have to try to retreat first, even if you could do so in complete safety with no risk. You no longer have to do that. You can stand your ground.
Amy, hopefully that answers your question. So it sort of reminds me of the old the way that state lines used to be drawn. You couldn't follow a suspect into another state, or the old Mexican standoff where bandits could come across the border, rob a bank, go back into Mexico, and then you couldn't follow them into their country. You cannot use this law to say to antagonize somebody, then run back to your area and say, "Oh, you can't touch me now."
Right, and that's always been a part of traditional self-defense law. It remains a part of self-defense law. The aggressor in any situation is not entitled to then turn around and claim self-defense. That has always been the case. It is still the case. So if you attack someone and then they turn around and start defending themselves, you can't use Stand Your Ground. It has to be a legitimate claim of self-defense. And to be a legitimate claim of self-defense, you can't be the aggressor.
Just as if somebody comes over from Ohio, robs a bank in Pennsylvania, they can be the laws have changed. You can pursue those people.
Oh, they're going to get
state.
Those people. Yeah.
Exactly. Pitt Law Professor David Harris is our guest. 412-246-2002, the number to call if you have a comment or question. Again, our email address, esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh. Follow the conversation at #EPLive. So let's talk about Florida, where this incident happened, and the case will unfold starting on Monday. We are told Florida has the most expansive Stand Your Ground law. So how does it work?
In Florida, Paul, the Castle Doctrine, right to defend yourself without retreat, it was the first state where that was taken out of the home and put in the public area. So you can defend yourself, stand your ground with deadly force in public, any place you have a right to be. And you are presumed to be making a correct self-defense call. That's a very important thing. There is a presumption that your claim of self-defense is correct and that the police will not arrest you unless they see something wrong with your self-defense claim. Now, not all other states, including Pennsylvania, don't share that. It also—
So the burden of proof is on the prosecution?
Essentially, yes. The burden of proof is on the prosecution in Florida, not true in Pennsylvania. You're entitled in Florida to a pretrial hearing in front of the judge to get the judge to rule on the correctness of a stand-your-ground claim if you are arrested anyway. Trayvon Martin's case, that was true, but his defense team has decided to forego that and make the stand-your-ground claim only at trial in front of the jury instead of in front of a judge. The other two things that the Florida law does is it protects people who are the shooters from criminal charges through that presumption of correctness, and it protects them from civil lawsuits. So the victim of the shooting or their family, if they don't survive, cannot turn around and sue them. This is all through a series of presumptions.
And so then if the burden of proof is on the prosecution, then why was George Zimmerman, why is this case going to trial?
Well, you remember at first he was not charged and not arrested.
Right.
That was the law in action.
But something changed.
And something changed. A special prosecutor was brought in. There became a public outcry at some point that this was not a legitimate self-defense claim. There was further investigation. A special prosecutor was appointed. She investigated the case over again and found that there was the basis for charges and the presumption was overcome. They did charge George Zimmerman ultimately, and he will be putting on his stand your ground case at the trial.
And again, how will George Zimmerman's defense team use stand your ground law as a defense in this case?
They will simply say that even though George Zimmerman followed Trayvon Martin, by most accounts, he followed him contrary to police instructions to stay in his car, that he, George Zimmerman, was attacked by Trayvon when they were face to face, that Trayvon was attacking him, and he only used his firearm as a way to defend himself. He was essentially standing his ground when he had not attacked Trayvon, had not launched a deadly assault on Trayvon.
We're talking about stand your ground laws, and when we return, we'll talk about what Pennsylvania has, whether Pennsylvania has anything like this. And we'll take your calls with Pitt Law Professor David Harris. Our number, 412-246-2002, 412-246-2002. What questions do you have about stand your ground laws? You can join the conversation and also email a question or comment to us at esspgh@wesa.fm and tweet us at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at #EPLive. It's Essential Pittsburgh, and we'll also convene a political panel with law professor Josebino Mystic and Post-Gazette columnist Tony Norman discussing city and state issues. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about stand-your-ground laws and the case of George Zimmerman, who shot and killed an unarmed 17-year-old named Trayvon Martin. That case goes to trial 1 week from today is when it is scheduled to start. We're talking about this with Pitt Law Professor David Harris. He's a member of an American Bar Association National Task Force on stand-your-ground laws, which is holding a regional hearing in Philadelphia this Thursday, which David can talk more about. You can join the conversation and ask about Pennsylvania's stand your ground law at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. David Harris, does Pennsylvania have anything like what we see in Florida and in other states?
There was a change in the law in 2011 here in Pennsylvania. There was discussion that we needed a stand your ground law like Florida's. However, no evidence that we were experiencing some kind of a plague of lawsuits against homeowners shooting people or something like that. Nevertheless,
so then why even have that law?
Well, there was public pressure. A lot of it came from the National Rifle Association and some other allied organizations. What happened ultimately was there was a law very much like the Stand Your Ground law in Florida that was proposed, but a number of the criminal justice professional associations in Pennsylvania managed to get it softened a bit. So the differences, the key differences in Pennsylvania are that in order to use a Stand Your Ground defense in Pennsylvania, you, the shooter, must not be engaged in an illegal activity. So it can't be used between gang members or in a drug deal or something like that. You cannot be in possession of an illegal weapon. And unlike Florida, you must first see a displayed deadly weapon in Pennsylvania. Another key difference is that the presumption in Florida that your self-defense claim is good does not operate. And so the police, when they were discussing this in the legislative process, they said they would feel free to charge somebody, and then the burden would be on the defendant to raise the Stand Your Ground defense. So the Stand Your Ground defense does exist in Pennsylvania. You can use Stand Your Ground outside of your home. You have no duty to retreat if you're under deadly threat, but you may be charged. You may be in the position of having to fight charges and assert the defense, unlike in Florida. And you have to have seen that weapon displayed against you and not be engaged in any illegal conduct.
So, in other words, in Pennsylvania, if the Trayvon Martin incident had happened here,
yes,
the burden of proof would be on George Zimmerman. He would have the burden to prove that, in fact, he was threatened, which in a sense he has to do anyway, but it's more of a burden in a state like this.
Yeah, the state here in Pennsylvania, the burden would automatically have started with him. In Florida, it starts the other way around and can be moved to a person like Mr. Zimmerman. The other big difference is that George Zimmerman would have to have seen the display of a deadly weapon by Trayvon, and no account I have read of the Trayvon Martin incident says that there was anything like that on Trayvon's part.
So how much does that do to the idea that because one of the most unsettling aspects of this case for a lot of people is the idea that Trayvon Martin was unarmed.
Yes.
But that may not necessarily matter in Florida. It would here in Pennsylvania, but
yes,
not down there.
Exactly. You know, Stand Your Ground laws, criminal law in general, it's all state law in the United States. The federal government has a very limited role in traditional criminal law. What these Stand Your Ground laws do in the most essential sense is they shift what we have traditionally looked at as the position of criminal law as being prevent deadly violence at all costs, and they move it the other direction. They say, well, in certain circumstances, deadly violence could be the first resort and not the last resort. What we've done here in Pennsylvania is kind of split it. We have not gone as far as Florida, but the law has moved toward the idea of using more deadly force as a response.
412-246-2002 is the number to call. Let's go to Mary in Cranberry. Mary, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, thank you.
Thank
you.
I
kind of wonder, in the respect of women especially that are being in abusive relationships or even have left the relationship and they're still being attacked or followed or threatened by that person who was abusing them and they left the relationship, or they're still living with that person?
That is a great question.
I really think it is a great question. And it involves so much more even than just the Stand Your Ground laws. The so-called battered spouse syndrome comes into play. This is something I teach about in my criminal law course. But just as far as Stand Your Ground laws, the domestic partner who is under attack would have that same Stand Your Ground right, as I understand it, as any other citizen of Pennsylvania. So if you came under deadly attack, whether inside or outside your home, You could stand your ground, you could use force, as long as, here we're in Pennsylvania again, as long as a deadly weapon, a firearm or other deadly weapon was displayed and you were not in the wrong in some way in your conduct.
There would seem to be a question, though, if you're talking about an abusive relationship where let's say it's a husband threatening his wife, and maybe he doesn't have a gun or a knife, but he's a big guy and he's got his fists. Would a woman have the right to brandish a weapon and maybe, in fact, use that weapon if she felt her life was threatened by the physicality of her husband or abusive partner?
Well, absolutely. That is a great question, and it's the essential question when you talk about battered spouse syndrome. It really does take you to the core of self-defense, because self-defense law, as it stood for centuries, has always required that there be an imminent, an immediate threat of deadly force. So you've got people who are physically mismatched, the man usually much bigger than the woman, with much more upper body strength. But say the man is not threatening with a weapon at the moment. This thing goes through a cycle, though. The violence is expected as part of a cycle. So these battered women cases that have come up over the last 20 years have all been about, could the woman effectively use deadly force to defend herself when the man is, say, asleep? She can actually take a shot at him when he's asleep. He's not posing an immediate threat, though. However, she knows that violence is coming because it's part of a continuous cycle that she's seen maybe for years. So it's a very difficult and thorny set of issues. We want to protect the victims of domestic abuse. On the other hand, the thinking goes, we can't have people shot while they're asleep. So it's very, very difficult, quite an interesting criminal law issue.
But a fist could be considered a weapon.
Oh, certainly. And you can imagine you don't even have to be a martial arts expert to have a fist be considered a deadly weapon. But if you were, it would be all the more.
I mentioned, David, that you are going to be attending an American Bar Association, or that you are, in fact, a member of an American Bar Association National Task Force on Stand Your Ground Laws. You are, or the group is holding a regional hearing in Philadelphia this Thursday. Explain what this is all about and what will be discussed.
Well, the task force by the American Bar Association has two functions at this point. It is to gather information on how the Stand Your Ground laws have really worked in practice, and it's to gather information from the field through public hearings. The meeting in Philadelphia on Thursday at 4 p.m. at the Philadelphia Bar Association is open to the public, and we'll be taking testimony from lots of people with many different points of view. We have also spent a lot of time gathering the empirical evidence on Stand Your Ground laws, and we found some surprising things.
Well, and I was going to ask you, how have they worked in practice?
Well, the initial talk was that this would cut violent crime in general because it would deter people when they knew folks could pull out a gun.
This was part of the NRA's reasoning.
Exactly.
For it. Okay.
And particularly it would deter homicides, and it would also just make people safe from lawsuits if they were the, quote, righteous shooter. What we found is that serious crime did not change at all in the states on a before and after basis when they either passed these laws or didn't. We found that the empirical evidence shows that homicide has gone up in Stand Your Ground states, a significant 8%, statistically significant amount, and there was never really any problem with people getting sued for these kinds of shootings in the first place. In other words, this was kind of a solution in search of a problem.
So based on what you're saying, might this be revisited and might the law be reconsidered?
Well, there are some states that are revisiting that. I know New Hampshire is in the middle of that process. I know other states may pick it up. But
how about Pennsylvania?
I know of no legislative action now on this, but it is certainly a question worth considering now. We have a few years of experience, and these things seem a lot less necessary and perhaps even harmful. So it's worth considering, and that's what the task force is really about.
And one last question for you. How do you see the Zimmerman case going?
It's going to be very, very difficult. You know, the reason that the prosecution brought the case and the reason the defense has chosen not to raise Stand Your Ground in front of a judge and only in front of a jury is that they think that the emotional content of the case that they will have with Mr. Zimmerman might be enough to persuade a jury that he was right or to hang the jury. That's the reason they put out some nasty things about Trayvon in the media, even though the judge isn't going to allow them into the trial. So I think this is going to be fought tooth and nail. I think it'll be close. I don't think it's going to be an easy case for the jury, not in either direction.
Pitt Law Professor David Harris talking about Stand Your Ground laws. As always, David, great thanks.
My pleasure, Paul. Good to be with you.